Welcome, this is James Corbett. You're tuned into CorbettReport.com on the 6th of September 2012, and today we are honored to be joined on the line once again by our old friend Tom Secker of InvestigatingTheTerror.com. So Tom Secker, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on again, James. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, well, great to have you here to talk about something that I know you've been following in some degree of detail, and it's a story that I have been following almost not at all, so it will be great to pick your brain about what's happened. And I'm referring to the trial and now conviction of Anders Breivik, and even the sentencing, which has just taken place. So there's a lot to talk about, and I'm not sure with a story of this size whether it's better to start at the beginning or at the end or maybe even in the middle, but perhaps we'll start at the end since I'm sure everyone has heard the news so far that Breivik was sentenced to 21 years in jail for his part in killing 77 and injuring over 200 people in an attack in Norway last year. And just as a flavor of the types of stories that are out there that are being covered right now, for example, Aram Online has an AFP report, Breivik's emails published in New Book in Norway from earlier this week, which was also covered on a blog called Views and News from Norway in an article titled Breivik's Email Branded as Boring. The Guardian is picking up on a story, British far-right extremists voice support for Anders Breivik. Whereas Reuters is saying analysis, Europe far-right shuns Breivik's acts, flirts with ideas. You have the Chicago Sun-Times saying Breivik ruling a victory for the rule of law, which is an interesting take. And then you have the Wall Street Journal from earlier last month, Oslo Breivik attack could have been prevented, according to a Norwegian commission. So a lot to cover. Let's start with the latest and the sentencing itself. Let's tell people what happened and what this really means in terms of Breivik's immediate future.
Well, I mean, his trial had been going on for several months, and the sort of hearings and witnesses and what have you had concluded in early July, and then quite recently we got the verdict, and he was completely unsurprisingly found guilty. Breivik had never disputed that he carried out these attacks, this bombing and these shootings. His argument was in essence that it was a political self-defense, an act of self-defense, and it's not that surprising that the Norwegian court didn't accept that and therefore found him guilty. But what they were also ruling on was whether or not Breivik is considered sane or insane, and there was quite a lengthy dispute before the trial in the months between his attack in July last year, and the start of the trial, which I think was February, March kind of time, because one set of psychological examiners concluded that he was sociopathic, that he was quite possibly delusional, that he was, to all intents and purposes, insane, at least at the time that he carried out this bombing and shooting rampage. Breivik then disputed this quite vehemently, and a second study and a second sort of examination was carried out, and that concluded that he was in fact sane. And then his trial, which wasn't a jury trial, I think it was just a trio of judges that made the ruling. There was quite a lot of argument about that, and Breivik was clearly very keen to be found sane. He sort of saw being found insane as a trivialization of what he'd done and why he'd done it. And so he was very insistent that he wanted to be found sane. And I think he even said, you know, if you find me sane, then I won't appeal it. I'll just go to prison and that'll be that kind of thing. Whereas if they found him insane, he would have appealed it and would have fought it and all the rest. So, yeah, he's now in prison. He's going to be there for at least 21 years, but in all likelihood, he's going to die in prison. They're just going to keep him in there. He has repeatedly said that if he got out or if he broke out or whatever, that he would just do the same thing again. So he's clearly an extremely dangerous man in terms of his intent. And assuming he was responsible for those attacks, which most of the evidence suggests he was at least partly responsible for those attacks, he's a very dangerous man in reality. So perhaps keeping him in prison, I don't know, maybe it is actually the best place for him. I'm not sure. But yeah, he's facing, I assume, the rest of his life in prison.
And as I understand it, they have the ability to continue to renew his sentence for five-year increments after that 21-year period expires?
Yeah. The sentencing was the maximum if you like, the maximum minimum sentence of 21 years. He will be there for at least 21 years. But there was also a provision in the sentencing allowed for in Norwegian law to essentially increase that indefinitely. They can just keep him there as long as they like.
All right, so obviously we've seen quite a lot of reaction over the past several days to this ruling, and as I say, it kind of goes across the spectrum of all sorts of different opinions and takes on what this really means, and you even, for example, have the Chicago Sun-Times talking about that ruling that he was sane and thus fit to stand trial being not only a victory for his point of view, but also a victory for the idea of the rule of law, because it's, as they argue, it's kind of too pat and neat to simply decree anyone with extremist ideas to be insane, because then that kind of abdicates their responsibility in a way. Lots of different takes on this. What can you say about the reaction to the ruling that you've seen so far?
Well, I mean, it's echoed, in essence, the reaction to the initial attacks and the initial sort of announcement that this guy Anders Breivik was responsible, and what were his motives, that he was politically some sort of political extremist, and that's what he was motivated by. In as much as it's kind of polarized, you've got a lot of people on the right, a lot of nationalistic people, some of whom have very real and very understandable concerns, and some of whom are, without meaning to just be derogatory about it, a bunch of crazy racists. And they seem quite conflicted by this, because they have this guy Breivik, who's being kind of put up on this pedestal in this trial. He's been given a lot of media coverage. He's been idolized to a large extent, in the way that we often do with spree killers in particular, but sort of terrorists and violent criminals in general. And so that he's been given a voice for this particular kind of point of view. Others who share aspects of that point of view have been kind of motivated and inspired by this to a large extent. A lot more of them have been vocal about having sympathies and having ideas and beliefs along those sorts of lines. But at the same time, all of them have sort of felt obliged to do the usual trite, oh, we condemn what he did, but not why he did it, kind of attitude. When also at the same time, quite often saying, you know, this is going to happen again, that, you know, there's a reason why Breivik did this, and therefore we can expect others like him. So you've got them on one side of this spectrum, and they seem very hostile towards anyone on the other side of the spectrum using this violence, and therefore using this sentencing to advance their political agenda, which is generally internationalist, multicultural, usually quite statist. I suppose they're both on both sides of the spectrum. They're quite statist. And so what I'm saying is each side has kind of tried to use this, just as they use the attack, to justify their pre-existing agenda. You've got those on the right who are saying, see, he is sane. This guy isn't just some crazy wacko who killed a bunch of people for no reason we'll ever understand. To them, this is almost a justification that, you know, their beliefs are sane, even if the actions of Breivik are horrible. And people on the left are sort of saying, see, this guy is sane. There is a real political danger from this. Therefore, we need to kind of exclude and to some extent demonize any form of right-wing nationalism. This has been the pattern ever since the attacks, is that these two kind of polar opposites have just been arguing with each other and being quite hostile and spiteful towards each other. There are some exceptions. I'm not saying there aren't voices that don't exist within those two poles, around those two poles. There are some, but yeah, that's the pattern that I've got out of the bit of reading of news reaction to this sentencing that I have read.
Well, certainly there has been a lot of divisive reactions and, as you say, a tendency towards two camps in the reaction to this and all of that. And obviously this has great ramifications for what's happening in Europe generally right now in the political situation there. So I'd like to get more into that perhaps later. But First, let's go back, let's circle back now to the beginning of this story and what it is that we can say that we know or that we still don't know about what actually happened that day last year when this attack took place, the extent to which we can definitively say that Breivik was or was not involved, and in what actions he was or was not involved, and to the extent that there may have been other actors. What have we really learned from this trial, and how did we learn it?
Well, the attack was on July 22nd last year. It began at around 3:30 in the afternoon, I think, was the with a truck bombing outside of a government building, a complex of government buildings in downtown central Oslo. It killed, I think the truck bombing killed 8 people, but it wounded quite a large number of people from, you know, broken glass and things. The video that we have that was shot by some random Norwegian, you know, some person in Oslo who kind of arrived on the scene minutes after the explosion. I don't know, there are some anomalies there. There are some problems with this story, in as much as there isn't really a crater where the truck was parked, or certainly seems to have been parked. There was just a kind of hole in the ground leading to the underground, leading into the sewerage system or whatever else is underneath that building. The pattern of which windows are broken is relatively random. It's not like you have lots of windows broken in the middle where the main explosion was and then sort of progressively less away from that. It really is kind of, you know, a few here and there, big patch here, big patch there. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense for one single explosion to have done that. There is a fire in the building opposite on the other side of the street, and it's not really clear why there's a fire there from a truck bomb that happened outside the building. And other things where there is CCTV from cafes and shops and what have you several streets away, which are showing their windows blown out. But there is no obvious pattern for the blast wave of the bomb to have got to that point and blown those windows out without blowing out every window in between. And they weren't. So there is this somewhat inconsistent and anomalous damage pattern that is suggestive of more than one explosion. However, it's not quite as quite as cut and dried as Oklahoma City, for example, where you just couldn't produce that effect in a building with a truck bomb. It's just ridiculous to even think that you know, the damage to the Murrah building was caused by a single truck bomb parked in front of it.
Just to clarify, were those anomalies addressed in any way during the trial, or were they simply ignored?
No, they were essentially ignored in the trial. This is something that was only really picked up by the independent media. And there is a particularly good video by Henrik of Red Ice Radio, Red Ice Creations, where he kind of went through this video and some of the photographs and images from Google Earth and what have you to explain this scene out, so you at least understand, you know, where everything is. I can't remember the name of it, but it's something like Oslo Bombing's Inconsistencies. But I certainly recommend watching that. No, it wasn't picked up by the trial. It wasn't picked up by the July 22nd Commission either. They weren't really looking at those kinds of questions.
All right, sorry, I didn't mean to disrupt the flow. So
No.
You can continue.
Okay. And then we get to later in the day, about an hour and a half later, maybe 2 hours later, Breivik, dressed as a policeman, arrives at the connection to this isle, the dock or whatever, the connection to this isle of Utøya, which is this little kind of 24, 25-acre island somewhat north and west of Oslo, that was owned by the Labour Party, the Norwegian Labour Party, privately owned island, and this is where they hosted their annual summer camp for the sort of junior members of the Labour Party. And this is where Breivik carried out, at least as far as we know, Breivik carried out his shooting rampage, and he killed another 69 people, some very young, some as young, I think, as 14. This was kind of like, you know, a youth summer camp, and he and possibly others turned up and just started shooting people. It was just a kind of, in one way, a random massacre, but in other ways a very specifically targeted one, because the reason why he says he blew up the government building or bombed outside the government building and why he attacked this Labour Party youth camp is because he very much blames the Labour Party for mass immigration, particularly mass Islamic Muslim immigration from the Middle East, which he sees as various things, as a political threat, as a threat to white European identity, all the sort of usual kinds of stuff that we've heard quite a lot of people talk about, in truth. The major problem with the island shootings is the possibility of additional shooters. Now, this is something you tend to get in all spree killings, is at least a few witnesses thinking there was more than one shooter. And sometimes, you know, sometimes one person has carried this out. But at the same time, I understand people's skepticism towards that because of the original lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. And that story is so patently false that, as a kind of general reaction, people are skeptical of the lone wolf, lone gunman kind of story. In the initial days after this bombing and shooting rampage, a few witnesses were interviewed who spoke of seeing at least one additional shooter on the island. Some spoke of hearing shots from different parts of the island at the same time. None of this is particularly specific. Then at the trial, as picked up by Britt of resistradio.com, there was a witness who said that kind of at the start of the shooting rampage that she thought she heard other people outside. She was kind of hiding in one of the, I don't know, holiday shacks or whatever that's on this island. And she said that she thought she heard other voices outside at the start of the shooting rampage speaking with foreign accents. And therefore she assumed, or at least at that point thought, that Breivik had accomplices. And this was, you know, this was kind of put out into the trial testimony. That in particular wasn't covered up in any way, but again, it was never really addressed in any significant manner, and it, as far as I know, it doesn't appear anywhere in the July 22nd Commission's report. So there's an outstanding question there. Ultimately, I do think it's possible that Breivik did all this at least on that day on his own. But it wouldn't at all surprise me if there were additional conspirators in terms of actually carrying out the violence as well.
And I know this is speculation, but what do you believe might be the point of that information? Do you think there may have been accomplices that he decided to cover up for the sake of helping them to get away, or there may have been something other to this shooting than what we've been talked about in terms of the motivation for it, or what might we be able to conclude from that?
Well, I mean, Breivik himself is a rather funny case, because he said that he's always been adamant that he carried out the attack on his own in terms of actually doing the bombing and the shootings. But he has also always said there were additional conspirators, in as much as he speaks of having a handler, that's his term, in Britain. And there is some speculation as to which of the various prominent kind of right-wing nationalistic figures that we know about in Britain might have been this handler. He says that he belonged to this Knights Templar organization, which is sort of quasi-Masonic, I suppose, Zionist organization, certainly anti-Islamic Zionist in that sense, organization that does appear to exist in a manner of speaking, but whether it exists exactly how Breivik describes, where there is some kind of hierarchy, where orders are passed down, that is much less clear. So he is kind of, he's claiming responsibility for the violence, but he's attributing his inspiration and, if you like, the facilitation of the attacks to others. And these others have never been, at least officially, never been caught, never been questioned, never been found in any way. So if Breivik wasn't the only conspirator, if there was a conspiracy, I don't suppose you can... Can you have a conspiracy of one person?
Multiple personality conspiracy. No, I don't think so. Not by definition.
If there was a conspiracy, if there was more than one person involved, then Breivik is covering up for them. But the flip side of it is, if Breivik did actually do all this on his own, then he's fabricated this whole Knights Templar wider right-wing nationalistic movement that he claims he was part of. And he has also spoken of there being two more one-man cells. Again, can you have a cell composed of one man? But two more one-man cells, presumably in Norway, waiting to carry out attacks. Now, if this was true, I'm kind of wondering, why didn't they do it when he was sentenced? But maybe I'm just kind of, you know,
well, that would be when one would expect such an attack, wouldn't it? Certainly. So it might be just talk and swagger. So in what sense, you say that in a certain sense, we can say that this Templar organization that he claims to be a part of does exist. But in what sense can we say that?
Well, in as much as other people seem to lay claim to being part of it. And we have also had this bizarre email that was sent shortly before Breivik was sentenced. I think I've got that right. Supposedly from his second in command, his deputy. But this person doesn't seem to have been tracked down. And this was kind of threatening more attacks and kind of praising Breivik in very glorious terms for what he'd done. So it does appear that there's more people out there that at least identify themselves as belonging to this same kind of movement, and at least a loose organization that has some connection to that whole Knights Templar, Knights of Malta thing that goes back centuries. Whether or not that means they actually have an organization and they actually have meetings and there is some kind of military hierarchy where instructions are passed down and people follow orders, there doesn't seem to really be any evidence for that. So we are looking at something that's kind of, you know, a bit like Al-Qaeda. Did Al-Qaeda ever exist as that kind of hierarchical structure, or was it always just a loose affiliation of Islamic radicals, lots and lots of which happened to be spies? And whether the Knights Templar is, you know, the same sort of thing.
Perhaps it's like Anonymous. If you claim to be part of it, you are.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what I'm wondering, whether we're seeing a sort of element of, it's not quite the copycat effect, but an element of essentially disparate people only being connected in as much as they all identify themselves in a similar way.
Well, that certainly makes sense. Well, the obvious question here is, you've raised the specter of this July 22nd commission that was supposed to look at various aspects of what happened and whether it could have been prevented, etc. Given that there were these anomalous pieces of information that at least bring into question whether or not Breivik acted alone, why would the commission not have looked at that? Why would there have been any reluctance on the part of investigators or police or whoever to really address these issues?
Well, this is where it gets a little difficult to figure out exactly what's going on and exactly what role the Norwegian government has been playing in this process, because among other things, the July 22nd Commission published its report before Breivik's verdict. So even before he'd been found guilty, it was inevitable he was going to be found guilty. But nonetheless, even before he'd been found guilty, they published their report saying he and he alone was responsible for this. So that's a bit kind of jumping the gun, in a somewhat understandable way, because no one was really disputing. Even Breivik wasn't disputing that he did this. Then you have a couple of things in this process which are actually quite credible, and where I think we have to give the Norwegian government their dues, that they did say that the police response, particularly the time it took for the Delta police, the counter-terrorism, you know, armed, suited and booted police, the time they took to get to Utøya Island, and this whole farce where they had a boat and then they overloaded it with equipment and it started sinking, and, you know, that whole, it was a complete mess. The security was a joke in terms of their response getting to the island, and also the security around the government buildings was a joke. It doesn't seem that there was any fences or guards or gates or, you know, any of the standard things you would traditionally expect from a Western European government protecting its buildings. And they were quite critical of quite a lot of people and quite a lot of institutions. The commission was quite critical over this. And this is all stuff that, you know, we never really saw this after 9/11. We never saw this after 7/7 or Madrid or any of these other attacks that we have very deep suspicions about. No one was ever held responsible. There was basically no criticism. In this case, there has been some criticism. The head of the Norwegian police has been made to resign. The head of the PST, the kind of Norwegian MI5, the Norwegian Security Service, resigned partly to do with this and partly to do with some other scandals. So some high up people have been, you know, have been ditched, have been junked, and therefore paid for their failures with their jobs. So I think we have to give them a bit of credit for that, wouldn't you say?
Well, it certainly is a step in the right direction, I would agree.
Well, in as much as governments ever do anything right.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But the flip side of this is that they basically said, no, the attacks couldn't have really been prevented, or maybe could have been if security had been a bit better, but it wasn't because of lots of different reasons. So they're not really holding anyone responsible in anything other than a kind of media way.
Right.
Even though these senior people have gone, they've kind of, you know, more people probably should have gone.
Well, that's something that you've pointed out many, many times, is that the idea, this meme of the security failures, is often used not as a way of really questioning the system, but in fact bolstering it and giving more power and money to the agencies that so signally fail in their duties to protect.
Yeah, and we've had a similar kind of dynamic here, in as much as Breivik was the subject. He was actually on security service files in Norway, but only in a very minor way. He turned up, his name turned up in the laughably named Operation Global Shield, which is a US State Department, I think, funded counterterrorism operation running all over the world, where they monitor purchases of chemicals that could be used in terrorism. And because Breivik bought some sort of bomb-making materials, I think from Poland, his name kind of briefly turns up on an Interpol list and a couple of Norwegian security service lists, and they don't ever really look into him. And I suppose if that is all that they had, that isn't really enough to have warranted looking into him in that much detail. But the problem with that whole manner of questioning and that whole, oh, well, you should have stopped him, you should have known that he was a danger, you should have caught him, is that everyone who ever buys some moderately suspicious chemicals should therefore be the subject of security service investigation. We're actually giving them an excuse to do that by kind of placing that demand on them. And that's exactly what they want us to do. So I find that line of questioning, it's an important one. What did they know? When did they know it? What did they do about it? Always important whenever you have a terrorist attack or any other similar sort of event to ask those questions. But you should always be wary when asking those questions that they are just going to twist it round. And the head of the PST did actually make this comment about how it's very difficult to stop a lone wolf terrorist. It's very difficult to stop one individual. Well, true enough. But she goes on to say, even the Stasi would have had a hard time stopping Breivik, or even if we put chips inside everyone's head, we still might not have been able to stop him. And it's, you know, that sort of comment, you just think, oh, yeah, we're back in that same old dialogue whereby we're saying, why weren't we more secure? Why isn't there more security? And they say, fine, here's your security. It's not a dialogue, and it's not a line of inquisition that we should take lightly. We should be very careful when we ask those questions and how we ask them, so that we don't just provide fodder for them to do what they were always planning to do.
Exactly right. I think anything along those lines that doesn't question the existence of these so-called security services itself is probably missing the point.
So where else can we go with this?
It's a very good question. I think it's a fascinating story because it's one of the ones that I think was immediately picked up on by the alternative media. And there was a lot of questions at the beginning whether this was some sort of false flag, as is often brought up in the wake of pretty much any major event, you know, spectacular type of violence like this. And I think it's one that I'm glad there are more people asking about this in the wake of every event. But it seems that some of the figures questioning this may have jumped the gun with what we did or didn't know at that point. And I guess the question that myself and a lot of people will have is, if this was some sort of false flag type event, what was the purpose of it and what really has resulted from it that would have furthered any type of agenda?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think people jump the gun a little bit. This whole question of exercises and false flags, which, you know, I am not in any way disputing that there is a long, long history of using exercises, simulations, military maneuvers, drills, all these kinds of different things as a means of carrying out or providing cover and deception for covert ops, including false flag terrorism. Tons of examples. One that not an awful lot of people know about is actually during the whole Gladio phase in Europe, there was an incident at the Vielsalm barracks in Belgium that took place during a NATO military exercise and was probably linked to that exercise. Certainly there's a lot of journalists who were interviewed for that magnificent Gladio documentary by Alan Frankovich who talk about this and say that basically there was a sort of attack team and a defense team, and that they were supposed to kind of carry out a simulated attack on the barracks, but then it was supposed to be cancelled, but they did it anyway so they could steal weapons and plant these weapons on a bunch of commies to set them up. So, you know, there's lots of different ways this can play out, but particularly in the Norway, in the Breivik massacre, in the Norway attacks, there was a bombing exercise in Oslo. This was widely reported by the mainstream Norwegian media even before the bombing. It was going on all that week, and it concluded about half an hour before the truck bombing, the van bombing outside the government building. So just as with Oklahoma City, we are left with this question that if there is this damage pattern that hints at additional devices, was that bombing exercise a means of either getting those devices into the building or at least ensuring no one found them before, you know, before they went off? It's a distinct possibility, but I've never really got the feeling, and this is just a kind of gut instinct thing, that the Norwegian government were behind this and they were the ones running that exercise. So another possibility, and this is just a guess on my part, I'm completely admitting this is just a guess, is that someone may have found out about that exercise ahead of time and planned the bombing to take place while the exercise was going on without the knowledge of the people running the exercise, if you're with me.
So you mean someone other than Breivik piggybacking onto the exercises as a way of... But someone other than Breivik people. Who knew Breivik was going to do what he was going to do, assuming he
or
did
was,
that.
Yeah, or was handling Breivik, or you know, sponsoring him or manipulating him in some way. Just a possibility. There is also this story that there was apparently an exercise on a Toyer Island in the hours before the shooting rampage. And if it was true, that would be obviously massively suspicious. But it doesn't appear to be true, because it seems to be based on two different little bits of information. One is a video of the Norwegian Delta counterterrorism police force that actually comes from a newspaper article over a year before the bombing that just sort of got picked up and confused with this story after the bombing. You can trace that back. There are people have put it on YouTube, and some people have pointed out in the comments, you know, links to the original story and so on.
And what does that video show?
Basically shows some guys kind of abseiling down a building and then chucking in a few flashbangs and jumping through the window. Doesn't really show very much anyway. The other major source, and this is the far more commonly cited one, is a newspaper article from Aftenposten, I'm probably mispronouncing that, talking about this, but it cites an anonymous Norwegian police source, saying there was an exercise on the island shortly before the real attack that was based on a similar scenario. And there's lots of different ways. I mean, maybe there was. I'm not categorically saying there wasn't. But my reasons for skepticism are, firstly, this is an anonymous source, and I don't really ever trust newspapers quoting anonymous sources. Secondly, because the comments that this anonymous source has made appear to fit much better with this bombing exercise in Oslo than anything happening on Utøya. And thirdly, no one on Utøya saw anything. of that kind, or no one has been reported, at least, seeing anything of that kind going on this privately owned island in the hours before the shooting rampage. So I think there's some good reasons to be sceptical towards that story, and I think some people did jump the gun and kind of just see the words exercise and thought, must be a false flag, cut and dried case. I don't think it's anywhere near as simple as that. But all that said, I am usually sceptical of anything that tries to claim something as a false flag based on news reports from the day itself or about the day itself. I think there's better places to look for that kind of evidence. And in this case, we do have some other evidence that's worth drawing on here, and that's in particular the manifesto and video that Breivik allegedly left posted on the internet shortly before the attacks happened. And both of them show the signs of having potentially been written by other people or put together by other people. The video, as Peter Dale Scott has analysed and others as well have commented on this, very much appears like the video work of a guy called Nick Greger, who is a kind of German, I think, right-wing nationalist who Breivik has obviously drawn some inspiration from. And the way that Breivik himself is kind of attached and images of him are kind of appended to the end of this video in a way that doesn't fit with the rest of the video's style and pacing, and it just looks like maybe someone shoved them in on the end to incriminate him and implicate him in making the video and therefore in carrying out this attack. And the video's just, you know, full of the same kind of rhetoric that we've seen from Breivik and seen from other people. The manifesto...
I'm sorry, I have not seen this video, so... is the video itself, the manifesto part of the video, does it actually include video footage of Breivik delivering this, or is it just kind of words on the screen?
No, it's mostly words on the screen. It's basically like a PowerPoint presentation that's been turned into a YouTube video.
So the indication is that it could have been done by literally anyone, and they just stuck his photos or whatever on the end to implicate him.
I'm not saying that's necessarily what
happened. But it could, right, I see. Yeah.
You know, if you watch the video, I imagine you'll get that impression from it, because it is a bit kind of clunky the way they've just stuck this picture of Breivik holding his gun, wearing his wetsuit, you know, right at the end of this video.
And it's in English?
Yeah, it's in English, as is the manifesto. In fact, he signs the manifesto and Andrew Berwick rather than Anders Breivik, a sort of anglicization of his name. There is that element to it, that both of these were in English. They weren't in Norwegian. This wasn't just about trying to inspire Norwegians towards opposition to Islamic immigration or possibly even inspire them towards terroristic violence. It seems to be aimed at a much, much wider audience. So he's put it in English, the most widely spoken language in Western Europe, at least Western Europe. And the manifesto is the same. It's like 1,500 pages long. It contains... I mean, I haven't read it, page 1 to page 1,500, but it contains a vast quantity of information, much of which has been drawn from the internet. And it's all about kind of European history. It's called 2083, A European Declaration of Independence. It's largely about European history, the role of Islamic migration, and in particular, what Breivik identifies as cultural Marxism. And he says that the whole purpose of this is specifically to undermine white culture, white European culture, through Islamic immigration, through mass-scale immigration that would, if you like, force us to live in a multicultural society. Now, there are some real problems with multiculturalism, and there are some real reasons to suspect that there are other motives behind it, behind why our countries have pursued this policy of immigration. But I think Breivik kind of gets a bit carried away in places. Or whoever wrote that manifesto, I should say, because it's not guaranteed it was him or just him. And I certainly don't, you know, I don't endorse that view. I don't really see mass immigration as having much to do with cultural Marxism. I think it has far more to do with economics. It has to do with perpetuating indefinite economic growth. You bring in lots of cheap immigrant labor. This is certainly what happened in this country. bring in a lot of cheap immigrant labor, it gives a kind of artificial boost to the size and the flow of money in your economy. It gives an artificial boost to your population growth as well. So in as much as at times our governments have pursued those policies and those aims, immigration has served them in doing that. That's the way I see it anyway. But besides that, yeah, getting on to the question of covert ops, because we need to circle back to the question you actually asked me. Breivik does... he studiously avoids mentioning much about the security services, but he is aware of Operation Gladio. He mentioned Gladio in Turkey in particular, and the whole connection to the this nationalistic Turkish organization called Ergenekon, which is connected to these sledgehammer trials in Turkey at the moment, if people know about those. And this is a kind of secular nationalistic organization working in the shadows that from their own kind of internal documents, which have been leaked, they identify themselves as a kind of nationalistic Bilderberg organization, if you can believe such a thing. And Breivik mentions that, you know, this was an outgrowth of the CIA and others using right-wing nationalism and even neo-fascism in the wake of the Second World War to fight the communists, to carry out false flag attacks, to assassinate major communists, to generally disrupt and destabilize Europe and drive hatred towards those leftists, communists, socialists, and what have you, that were becoming popular in some countries. And he even mentions Gladio by name only once, but he does mention it in this manifesto. So he is clearly aware of these things, or whoever was writing this manifesto was clearly aware of these things. Yet it never fits into his worldview, if you like. It never comes around and actually feeds into his, well, this is my picture of the world and this is why I am doing what I'm doing, which is strange to say the least.
Just to be clear, I understand you. How do you think that should, or how would that manifest if that did feed into his worldview?
Well, simply it would contradict his whole thing about he's obsessed with Islamic terrorists, or whoever wrote that manifesto is obsessed with Islamic terrorists and makes all sorts of claims that are actually untrue, such as Muslims are responsible for most terrorist attacks. That is sort of demonstrably untrue, regardless of which set of statistics you use. And the fact that, not specifically with Gladio, but that there are so many covert operations involving Islamic terrorism as a proxy force,
right,
as a, you know, all the double agents, all the things that, you know, we've spoken about at some length, that should contradict that view of Islam as just this kind of wild, unkempt, dangerous thing that's kind of invading Europe. And it should kind of bring it home to Breivik that, in fact, radical Islam is something we've very much encouraged and sponsored at various times for various purposes.
Well, then I suppose the only way that I could really understand this as some sort of false flag that had anything to do with the security services is if it was some sort of reverse Gladio, not to portray the left wing as a bunch of radical violent crazies, but in this case to portray the right wing as a bunch of radical violent crazies. And as you indicated earlier, you said that the right wing in Europe is generally saying they condemn these attacks but support kind of the view. Well, that's, I suppose, the point of a demonization campaign against a particular political caste. So is there any indication that this could be the work of some sort of anti or counter or opposite mirror Gladio type of team?
No, and I mean I gotta be honest here. I haven't really seen much of a crackdown on that kind of view. If anything, Breivik's actions have bolstered people in those sorts of views and made them more prone to talking about them. There hasn't really been a demonization of that right-wing nationalism. And you also have to remember that it wasn't Gladio's sole purpose was specifically to demonize communism. It was broader than that. For example, we have the shooting rampages in Brabant in Belgium in the 1980s, which were kind of similar to what Breivik did, in as much as they just kind of slaughtered random people. A bunch of guys in balaclavas with shotguns who were probably working for Belgian special forces or at least connected to them just went into supermarkets periodically and shot a bunch of people. And the effect of this was not about demonizing communism in Belgium. There was no real communist movement or communist party in Belgium at the time. It was more about just creating fear, creating tension, the strategy of tension, as a means to advancing the security services and to, as a means to advancing that agenda and that direction for the state. So I haven't really seen much evidence that that particular kind of reverse Gladio scenario that you're talking about either was the purpose of this or has been the impact of it, has been the consequence of the attacks. But I do wonder if we have a kind of broader interpretation of what Gladio was all about. Does it fit in that sense? And I think it does, in as much as that has been the result. The attack that Breivik carried out was the biggest terrorist attack in Western Europe since Madrid in 2004. It got an awful lot of attention. By comparison, shootings in Liège in last December, and even the Toulouse shooter, Mohamed Merah, who had the security services were all over, he went on a shooting rampage in Toulouse in March this year. They got some coverage, but nowhere near as much as Breivik has. So I wonder if we forget about the specific politics and don't think of this as being about advancing or demonizing any particular part of the political spectrum or any particular political view, but just understand it in terms of the dynamics of fear and security, or fear, therefore security, whether it makes more sense as a covert operation in that way, I think that is probably the most fruitful way of interpreting this if you're kind of going down that route.
Indeed, and that kind of puts into contrast the question that I was about to ask, which is the inevitable question, do you think this is likely to breed more copycat-type activities? Do you think this will see an increase in violence? I mean, how do you think this is likely to play into the European political situation generally, which, of course, I don't know personally, I'm not there, but it seems from this perspective to be already quite divided, with people on both sides of the issues being quite worked up, and already I think there's so many indications that there's a deeply, deeply divided community out there. And of course, as you say, not everyone is around those poles, but those two poles do tend to get all of the attention. So is this likely to play into increased tensions, and if so, in what way?
Well, I mean, I think it already has, and I think it is very much likely to produce further tensions. It's a somewhat trivial example, but you may remember that a couple of months back you had some political debate on Greek television, and the member of the far-right so-called neo-Nazi, I think they're the Golden Dawn Party, was physically confronting and even being quite sort of aggressive towards the members of the left-wing kind of Syriza party, Syriza movement. And this became quite a big scandal, and quite a lot of people saw this.
Didn't he brandish a gun, or was that the one he hit some other panelist?
I think that was the one where he hit someone. Right. I think the brandishing the gun was actually from something else.
Right.
but it's this sort of thing, you know, just this ratcheting up of tension. I know that's in some ways quite trivial, but it's in terms of public perception more than, I suppose, actual activities, actual people, doing things. And in terms of perceptions, I think there is a lot more tension in Europe these days. It's not just about the economic situation, but obviously that's central to it, because without a single currency, it's hard to see how the notion of a single united Europe could either manifest or survive. Not that I'm in any way in favor of a single united Europe, but I'm just saying that project, that whole agenda, is very much under scrutiny. It has an awful lot of opposition and resistance to it. An awful lot of people, I think, are now cottoning on to, you know, it's just another massive debt Ponzi scheme, and therefore, inherently, you're just better off out of it, almost regardless of what your alternative is. I think it will contribute to that. And I do think we will see copycats. I mean, Breivik is like a walking advert for a copycat. He's very much encouraging other people to follow in his footsteps. There is another angle that I did pursue with this that I think you'll find quite interesting. Did you read my article on the connections between Anders Breivik and David Headley?
I'm going to admit that I have not, no.
Well, fine. I'll just quickly run through my list of similarities between the two. David Headley is this probable CIA spy in Lashkar-e-Taiba who was behind the Mumbai massacre of November 2008. We have spoken a bit about Headley before. Very, very interesting guy, and in a lot of ways quite similar to Breivik. And when you look into their backgrounds, it's perhaps not that surprising why. I mean, both of their fathers were diplomats. David Headley's father, who was a Pakistani guy, member of a political Pakistani family, he worked at the embassy in Washington and later then worked for Voice of America, that, you know, CIA front organization. So it's possible Headley's father actually was CIA. Breivik's father was the Norwegian diplomat in London. And, of course, embassies in London are full of spies. Not that I'm saying Breivik's father was a spy, but it's just interesting. They were both diplomats. Both of their parents were divorced. both divorced, in fact, when they were quite young. Breivik's parents were both Norwegian, whereas I suppose Headley's were... His father was Pakistani, his mother was American, so it's a bit different there. They both went to elite schools, like posh schools. Breivik went to, I can't remember the name of the school, but it was the same place that the Crown Prince of Norway went. Headley went to this elite Pakistani kind of military college. That's where he was educated. They both incorporated false flag elements into their attacks. Breivik, when he carried out his bombing and shooting, was running around, apparently, dressed in this kind of police body armor wetsuit outfit of some sort. And when he was getting onto the island, he says he did this because it would, you know, the people running the boats and what have you would assume he was a policeman and that he was going there because they'd heard about this bombing in Oslo and that, you know, they'd be safe and that, you know, he was a good guy and therefore they'd just help him get onto the island and do what he was going to do. Headley, when he put together this gang from Lashkar-e-Taiba to do the Mumbai massacre, or at least parts of the Mumbai massacre, he bought them saffron yellow golden wristbands from he made several reconnaissance trips to India to plan these attacks, and he bought them these wristbands, and these wristbands are the symbols of the Hindutva, kind of Hindu nationalist radicals in India, i.e. the opposite people to the Islamists in Pakistan. And when this gang turns up in Mumbai to carry out these bombings and shootings, they're wearing these wristbands, almost like they were trying to pretend to be Hindu radicals when, in fact, they were Islamic radicals. Very strange. And, of course, they both end up in court. Breivik ends up in court being held responsible for this terrorist attack, whereas Headley managed to shift most of the blame and most of the responsibility onto Howard Rana. But... you know, there is a pattern, if you like, in their backstories that is rather similar. And I kind of posed the question at the end of this article, are these the new faces of the kind of war on terror version too? That they're both white, you know, they're both white Westerners. Are we looking at, partly in these events, a kind of shift of the agenda? That Muslim terrorism, Islamic terrorism, is no longer the number one focal point for all of this, and they are, broadening the scope of what we are fighting in the war on terror, which is something you've talked about quite a lot. Mm. I mean, I'm just wondering here. Mm. You know, there's an avenue.
And
I think,
of course, that is complementary to the idea of the security services wanting to create the fear and tension anyway. So either way, I think that does play into it. So absolutely, I see what you're saying, and it is, of course, speculative, but it would be one way in which this might fit into a pattern.
And yeah, you're dead right. The fact that we've, if you understand the strategy of tension as being about not necessarily advancing one part of a political spectrum or another, but just about polarizing the political spectrum, about trying to divert people into one of two sides of an argument or two sides of a dialectic, then, of course, you would need your spy terrorists in Al-Qaeda and whatnot to promote and establish the Muslim terrorist threat, But then you need the counterpoint to that. You need the opposing pole. Well, what is the opposing pole? It is right-wing, white, Zionist nationalism, which is apparently all of the things that Breivik represents. So,
and who is the one to save us from it all is the security services. So,
yeah, yeah. And again, you know, it broadens the threat. It polarizes the discourse. This all just sounds like the strategy of tension to me. Whether that's, you know, the whole story behind Breivik, I don't know. It is possible. The other kind of hypothesis I put forward is that it's possible he is like a Gladio copycat, that he knew about these right-wing nationalist organizations that you know, were involved with the CIA and MI6 and everything. But without him actually being involved with the security services, he kind of took it on himself to do the same thing. It is a bit strange that when he was on the island, apparently shooting all these kids, he phoned up the police, the Delta, the counterterrorism police, and the first thing he said to them is, "This is Commander Anders Behring Breivik of the Norwegian Anti-Communist Resistance Force." But the only anti-communist resistance force in Norway's history was Gladio. So, yeah, weird stuff, but tantalizing, if you like.
Is that potentially something to do with translation, or is that a literal, you know, word for word?
Well, that's the translation that I've seen that the mainstream media seems to have used an awful lot. I haven't actually run those tapes by a Norwegian to check that. But that's what, you know, that's what the Telegraph and that's what the Guardian were putting out there as the translation of these recordings. Mm-hmm. So,
well, interesting anyway. Yeah, certainly a lot of different things to pick up from there. But I guess the only other point that I wanted to follow up with is, if this is likely to spawn copycats in one way or another, and if that's what Breivik himself obviously wants to have happen with this, or at least says he does, then what would be... what do you think the media will be able to act in a responsible way in basically silencing his side of this and putting it to rest in that sense, and not spawning the copycats, as unfortunately the media tends to do when they focus on these issues? Or how do you think the this is going to play out in the coming years, and whether or not you know, that this will be, I suppose, hyped up or made into something that could be more polarizing than it needs to be?
Well, I mean, they've certainly already played a role in doing that, and I don't really see any reason for them to stop. I've been reading some of the letters that Breivik has been sending out, people have been writing to him in prison, and I've been reading some of his replies, and he talks about wanting to write 3 different books about all of this. And I can only assume, given how marketable such books would be, that he's going to get a publisher, and that those books are actually probably going to see the light of day, and consequently will be reviewed by all of these different newspapers and media organs, and the whole thing will just carry on and perpetuate. I think they've, you know, from a kind of tabloid media point of view, and pretty much all the mainstream media these days is tabloid, Breivik is their wet dream. He is a smart, I suppose, relatively good-looking, certainly very articulate man who is, you know, compelling to listen to, who has a very extreme view that contains elements that quite a lot of people agree with. He's carried out this horrible thing, but without, it seems, being crazy or insane in any way. I think he's everything they want. He is their, you know, he's a story that's just going to run and run for them. I think they're... I mean, they're a bunch of sick bastards in the mainstream media, but this, you know, this is what they want. This is the story that they want. And so I think they will just keep reporting it. And I don't think they will behave responsibly regarding copycats and all of that at all.
A radical Western European political terrorist gets thrown in jail for an act of violence and writes a book whilst in jail. I can't see how that would turn out poorly. Anyway... I'm sure his book about his struggle will be greatly received by certain quarters of the European society. Well, a lot to digest. And I don't really know where else to take this. Is there anything else you'd like to say in summary, or anything that we didn't touch on that you'd like to bring to listeners' attention?
Just that there may be a sort of through pattern with some of these shootings. We've seen an awful lot of shootings in the last... certainly in the last year and a half, or well, year or so since Breivik did this. In Europe, we had two major ones, one in Liège, as I mentioned, one in Toulouse. And the whole thing, to me, does have the kind of stink of Gladio about it, but I'm not very sure. But I do know there is a new book out on Gladio by a guy called Richard Cottrell, who I've exchanged a few emails with, and he very much pursues that kind of hypothesis about this kind of just ratcheting up of tension, and that maybe we are seeing a reincarnation of Gladio, not just with Breivik, but with these other shooting events as well. I can't remember the name of the book, but if you look up Richard Cottrell and Gladio, I'm sure you'll find it.
Why does that name ring such a bell?
I'm not sure. He's a former European MP, I think.
Hmm. I'm sure I've heard the name. Perhaps I'm thinking of someone else. Well, I will check into
it. He writes on End the Lie. You might have seen his stuff there.
Hmm, yeah, I probably have, actually. All right. Yes. I think that might be it. All right, well... Okay, so I will definitely check out that book, and I'm greatly interested in this topic. I don't really know what else to say about it, but certainly there's a lot to digest here, so I'm sure we can have conversations about this and some of your other work besides in the future. Let's tell people a little bit about what you are working on right now.
Well, I am just completing a large but hopefully very accessible book on 7/7. I'm currently in the process of trying to find a publisher. I'm not 100% sure what I will do if I don't find a publisher, i.e. how I will put this book out there. It will be out there in one form or another, hopefully in the first few months of next year, regardless of whether I find a publisher. I've kind of made the decision that, yeah, it's going to be out there then. Aside from that, I'm working on a sort of number of smaller projects that are at kind of early stages at the moment, but that are about kind of trying to broaden people's perspectives and broaden people's tools for accessing the whole notion of false flag terrorism and the whole notion of the security state and what we're seeing about that. Kind of based on these conversations I've been having with Aaron Franz of The Age of Transitions. We recorded another one yesterday that should be up either today or tomorrow, that kind of pursue this from a somewhat more philosophical angle that I very much recommend people listen to. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff going on. It will all be on my website in one way or another at investigatingtheterror.com. And yeah, there is plenty more to come on this, but as I'm sure you're aware, it's all about finding the time and finding the inspiration to deal with it all.
Exactly right. Well, I'm very much looking forward to that, so I hope you will keep me informed, and I hope people will stay tuned to investigatingtheterror.com for more of that. And of course, we should also direct people to some of the articles that you've written about the Breivik massacre if you want more information about that, including the Breivik Headley Connection article that you were talking about. You've done a conversation with Mr. Britt of resistradio.com and Anders Breivik Gladio Copycat. Were there any other things that you've done particularly on that angle?
There are no other full articles I've written on it, no. There is also me and Britt appeared on Red Ice Radio.
Right.
And
yes,
quite a lengthy discussion with Henrik all about this. And there aren't very many podcasts and what have you out there about Breivik, so I'm glad that, you know, someone with as big a traffic as Red Ice wanted to discuss it, and you as well. You know, there isn't enough material on this case yet, so I'm glad and I'm grateful for you having me on your show again.
All right.
So thank you, James.
Well, you're very welcome, and anytime. I am always fascinated to discuss your research, so we'll leave it there for this evening. So once again, Tom Secker, investigatingtheterror.com, thanks for your time.
Thank you, James.